Jay.
Good morning. I'm convening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue, January 30th. We have today only an informational meeting on two or three topics. We'll see how much we can get to. Mr. Alanak.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. So we're shifting gears a little bit this morning, and Dave Beck is going to provide an overview orientation on school finance. So we'll get in a little bit into the funding formula, and it's a timely topic for the session. So.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Dave Beck, Legislative Revenue Office. If my slides look monotonous, especially in terms of color, it's by design. We are going to use less emotion because we get worked up when we talk about school finance. It's about formula revenue. It's not about grant and aid. Sources and distribution of formula revenue. So we're going to start with background information and big picture, and then we go to sources of revenue. And then we talk about formula.
Something that you said in the opening, I'd like to make sure is very, very clear. I might be channeling Representative Smith on this because we both have served on Ways and Means for so long. Please, just for the public who might be listening, explain the difference between formula funding and grant and aid. What is grant and aid?
So, Madam Chair, the grant in aid is dollars given to or distributed to school districts with specific projects in mind. And as Ways and Means members are aware, for 17-19, we have about $1.8 billion appropriated for that purpose. So they are like strings attached grants to school districts.
Thank you.
So, and this formula revenue is about school operating revenues. Independent of granting aids. So the first point, we're going to talk about background information, and then we talk about formula revenue sources, and then very technical formula itself, and then have some additional information. So operationally, and we have distribution charts for 15 through 19. When the legislature approved 17-19 budget, and the big picture about formula revenue distribution. So operationally, formula revenue available is the sum of state school fund that state legislature appropriates, and the local revenues collected by school districts and education service districts. Now we're going to get to the details of the sources of state school fund and local revenue, but just bear with me for now. This is the revenue available. Then we have carve-outs off the top, and we're going to talk about carve-outs too. So then for the remaining revenue available, school districts gets 95.5%, and then education service districts gets 4.5%. Within SD and ESD shares, there are statutorily defined grants and distributions. So this is the chart we generate, and school budget is formed. So for 17-19, the state school fund was $8.2 billion. the corresponding local revenue was about $4 billion. That's 1719. We modified a little bit. Because we appropriated a little more, a lot of resources and a little more marijuana resources, we reduced general fund a little bit. Later in the session, but we kept state school fund at $8.2 billion. That is in Senate Bill 5529. That's a little background. So big picture one. So we said that state school fund plus local revenue becomes dollars available for school districts and ESDs. What are the carve-outs off the top? Now, before we distribute based on 95.5 and 4.5 shares, we take out this amount from the top. What are they? Small high school grants, $5 million. A biennium, 2.5 a year. Talented and gifted speech pathology, it's about $500,000 per biennium. School district, about $1.6 million per biennium. So in the statutes, some are specified in terms of per year, and some are in terms of biennium. Network for quality teaching and learning. It's $5 billion off the top, but within school districts and ESD shares, they're about $17 million per biennium share. So each school district and ESDs will contribute about $17 million each per biennium to this MQTL. But that comes out of school and ESD shares, not off the top.
Representative Rushkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe the committee might have the answer to this question. I just don't know. So I'm wondering, the carve-outs, are they set in statute, or is this something that Ways and Means does every biennium and sets those numbers?
Madam Chair, Representative Rushkin, they are in the statutes.
Okay.
Mostly in 327.008, but some are specified in some other places.
Okay, but they're in statute. That's not something that Ways and Means every 2 years decides we're going to give not $5 million to small school grants, we're going to give $8 million. That has to be changed in statute. Okay, thank you.
By the way, some have like small high school grants.
Yeah.
Will sunset in 2020. So
all right.
In the past, the legislature extended that sunset. Yeah.
And if I have my way, it won't. But yes, okay, go ahead.
The next item is long-term care and treatment. And pediatric nursing facility and state school. So long-term care and treatment and state school, about $21 million per biennium, but there'll be some general fund expenditure on this long-term care and treatment. That portion is there too. Pediatric nursing facility, about $5 million per biennium. Office of school facilities. Sorry, I'm spending too much time on these carve-outs, but they are important carve-outs. Office of School Facilities. We have awesome program, OSCIM, which is about school facility improvement. So you're fixing schools, adding roof, stuff like that. 2015 legislature using geobond, using the process of geobond, when school districts raise money for that purpose, then the state will match up to $4 million.
Okay.
And above that, there's a formula, but goes up to $8 million state aid. So it's for school facility improvement purpose. So in 15-17, the legislature appropriated $125 million. And then for 17-19, we have $120 million available. English language learner, this is 2017. The legislature created this ELL carve-out, $12.5 million per biennium. This is totally independent of the additional weights we'll be talking about. And for a no-charge school lunch, another $2.5 million. Local option equalization grant, this is for school districts raising local option to help pay for operating expenses, but property tax poor districts. They try, but they can't raise enough money. The state will give some additional fund for that purpose. Reserves and others, first others, there was a big charter school relocation from one district to another. So to help alleviate this charter school closure, legislature appropriated, set aside some fund that's going to expire at the end of 2019. So that's a sunset. Reserves, to be prudent in finance, ODE will set aside some reserves. Now, these reserves actually will be eventually distributed based on formula. All right, a lot of time on carve-outs, but then take out all these carve-outs for the remainder. SD share is 95.5, ESD share is 4.5. Now, we said within SD and ESD shares, there are statutorily defined grants and distributions. High-cost disability grant, this comes out of school share. Facility grant comes out of school share. And I already mentioned the school district share of NQTL, Quality Teaching Network. By the way, starting from 2019 school year, becomes Educator Advancement Council. And the fund is called Educator Advancement Fund. So this NQTL money will be Educator Advancement Fund. Gotta get used to the term. So then what happens is they take out all these grants and share of NQTL will be used for general purpose grant and transportation grant. Again, bear with me, we're gonna get to the details of these grants, how they are determined. So education service districts gets 4.5% of the remaining dollars available. 10th grade assessment, about half, or $1 million per biennium. And the ESD share of NQTL, by the way, schools and ESDs share the same burden. So this year for 17-19 is about $17 million per biennium. So NQTL funds is about, altogether for 17-19, it is a little over 39 million per binary. So that's a summary of prior two slides for your reference. So sources of formula revenue. It's state versus local. State school fund, local revenues. Roughly two-thirds come from state school fund, one-third from local revenues. We're not going to talk about history at this point. We have plenty of time, either at JCSS or in some other occasions, about it was one-third from state and two-thirds from local revenue before Measure 5, Measure 15. But this is what it is. This is the current constraint we have. Two-thirds from state school fund, one-third from local revenues. For 17-19 school years, legislature appropriated 8.2 billion state school fund, and local revenue was about 4 billion. State school fund, what are the sources? General fund, lottery resources, marijuana revenue, and I deliberately didn't add education stability fund, hoping that we will never use education stability fund, but can be used for state school fund and an emergency. Local revenues. It is, the sources are explicitly stated. So if any fund is not listed here in ORS, they're not part of local revenue. If districts solicit donation locally, will not be part of local revenue. So what are the sources of local revenue? Permanent rate-based property taxes, about 95% of total local revenue is permanent rate-based property taxes. Common school fund distribution, we have some discussion about this, actually. In the past, distribution is 4% of last 3 years of fund balance. Starting from 19, actually, it declines to 3.5%. The reason being state lands are asked to chip in to help out school districts' unfunded liability fund. What happens is the state lands they get proceeds from unclaimed properties, so money flow in, money flow out. So at about, I don't know how much money they have from unclaimed properties, but the proceeds from there are being directed to school districts' unfunded liability. That's part of PERS contribution, actually. So in anticipation of some contribution to that fund, the land board decided that to preserve the sanctity of the fund, they decided to reduce the distribution to 3.5 instead of 4%. But that's for a limited time. I think this contribution to unfunded liability fund ends 2027. So that's a limited time commitment. It's about, used to be about 55, 16 million per biennium because of reduced distribution. And because we had terrible performance last year, we will have a little smaller contribution from Common School Fund for a couple of years. County School Fund from various sources, about $10 million per year. The state timber sale revenue, about $22-23 million per year. Occasionally, we have federal timber payment. There was a lapse in 16-17, but we have reauthorization of 17-18 and 18-19. But that's in the past. Looking forward, 19-21, we're not going to have this money at this point because that's not been authorized, reauthorized for 19-21 years. Occasional federal funds without specific application, no strings attached federal money. Local revenue, money in lieu of property taxes. So federal BLM lands, instead of paying property taxes, because they are not paying taxes, so they'll be paying some money to help out counties and the schools and ESDs will have a cut. Local option property tax is about statutorily allowed limits. With the lead of Representative Smith Warner, we increased this local option property tax cap last session. Oh, 2017 session, excuse me. So we have quite a cushion at this point, but for a limited time, I'm sure. this is the forecast we put out every year, and especially this time, very important, toward the end of February, after state revenue forecast, we'll be putting out local revenue forecast. We provide this to school revenue technical committee, and the legislature will take this into consideration. But this is one of the considerations they will do in deciding appropriations to schools. By the way, we had in our forecast, we mentioned that about 95% of local revenues permanent rate based property taxes. So it is very important to have a good estimate of property tax growth. Now, in our forecast, we assumed high threes for 17-19. Now, it turned out that we had a little better property tax growth. It's in terms of imposed taxes. So collection-wise, it's a little different. Imposed taxes collections are two different animals. So in terms of property tax forecast, because our office is charged with putting out local revenue forecast, the property tax forecast is very, very important for us. We assume high threes in our forecast, but in reality, we have statewide, sorry about this small numbers, but a little over 4% growth. So that's the starting point, and that's a
be a much older bond.
That's in line with our forecast. About distribution formula. So again, we are not attaching emotions. It's about mechanics. It's about technical details. So again, I want to have very monotone voice. try to actually. What formula is and is not about a distribution principle. And please remember that a formula revenue for a school district is the sum of general purpose grant, transportation grant, high cost disabilities grant, and facility grant. So there are four grants in terms of state school fund distribution. Some terms in formula and then cost factors. In formula, with focus on student cost weights. So we say state school fund distribution, we're talking about formula revenue distribution. Formula first, so let me talk about the mechanics. Formula revenues to districts are determined based on very complicated formula. Districts keep their local revenues in their account, and for a school district, if apportioned formula revenue is greater than local revenue, the state will provide the difference. On the other hand, if apportioned formula revenue is equal to or less than local revenue, there's no additional money from the state to the district. And it's the difference. There are four school districts in Clatsop and Tillamook counties that have local revenues exceeding apportioned formula revenue, but they keep the difference. On the other hand, for an ESD, extra local revenue is turned over to the formula revenue pool as part of school district's revenue for the following year. So when an ESD has local revenue exceeding the formula revenue, general services grant they're entitled to, and they're going to turn over excess revenue to their component school districts based on ADMW. And then school districts will use them for next year's local revenue. But that's in terms of calculating formula revenue available, it's almost a wash. What formula revenue is, these are the topics that should be discussed, especially in JCSS. But formula is devoid of these considerations. It's not about general cost reimbursement. There are some elements that some of the costs are reimbursed, but it's not about general cost reimbursement. It's not about revenue entitlement per student. It's not about funding adequacy or stability. It's not about outcomes. It's not about achievements. It's not about program quality or accountability. Now, all these, we get excited about talking about all these issues, concepts. The revenue committee is about technical details, mechanics. These are very, very, very important topics that should be discussed. We can discuss these topics in our committee, but there are better venues for these topics. Now, what the formula is about measuring relative need of district for funding, given student and district characteristics. It's about students, it's about districts.
Yes, Representative Smith Warren.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for this day, as always, and thank you for your patience with us. I wanted to say something that my Joint Committee on Student Success co-chair often says, Senator Roblin, which is the state school funding formula, it is a distribution formula. It's not a spending formula. It is merely a distribution formula. And because it has so many elements that take other things into account, people often aspire it to be things that it is not. But I just wanted to reinforce your comment that it is merely a distribution formula.
Well, thank you.
So what are the principles of state school fund distribution? Share school funding sources statewide. Let each district, including school district and universities, let each district decide how to spend its allocation. So the state will give aid in lump sum, not in categorical grants. Just funding only for uncontrollable cost. Well, differences among districts. Avoid incentives to increase district allocation. So minimize classifications and set limits. So setting limits comes into play. Some terms and formula, ADM is average daily membership. By the way, we have school finance director present, Mr. Will Fung. So when I get in trouble and when I don't have answers to, and if I state wrongly, he will come to the rescue. So thank you for being here. So ADM is average daily membership.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Representative Rescue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just on the average daily membership, does membership mean students are in seats in school, or does membership mean they're on the rolls of a particular district?
So when we talk about average daily membership, it's roughly headcount, the resident students' headcount.
So again, to clarify, that headcount meaning that they're in school, attending school, or they're on the roster to be in school?
Good question. I think
and as we sit down, I'll just remind you that for the record, you need to state your name.
Right. Good morning, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. For the record, Mike Wolfong with the Department of Education. I'm the Director of School Finance and School Facilities. Thank you for having me here with Day. In regards to Representative Reske's question about average daily membership and how is that accounted for, is that seat time? Is that virtual? The answer is that we have a variety of settings that we provide education. And we have, at this point, we have 16 different program types in which we use to account for average daily membership. The primary one is we use session days. And so essentially, that does, for the most part, represent seat time. But also, our virtual setting also uses that same way to account for it, in the sense that the students are checking in twice a week with the teacher of record. So, okay. And that's in the virtual setting. So we have a variety of settings, but the average daily membership essentially is just identifying how much time, whether it be hours of instruction, whether it be days of instruction, and some form of measure in order to account for the time that the students are receiving instruction. And it's essentially a full-time equivalency. So as Day, I think, was starting to allude to, is that we have more students, a headcount, than we do average daily membership, because the average daily membership is taking into account the times that the students are actually in session. So, for example, if a student comes in later in the year, they wouldn't receive a full ADM for the year. They would receive a prorated amount based on their attendance.
Thank you. I guess my question goes to, I read that Oregon has a chronic absentee rate of 11%. And so I want to know, is the school getting funded for that 11% for those not being there, or is there a way we can incentivize schools to ensure that they get paid only if the student shows up in class?
Right. I can speak a little bit to that. Chair Nathanson, Representative Reske. I've been part of a committee to review chronic absenteeism and attendance. And I believe, to answer your question, are they receiving funding for that? Yes. In our funding formula, we identify days present plus days absent, and then we divide that into total session days. So to answer your question, for those days absent, they are receiving funding. The rationale is that just because a student's absent, the building, the teacher, the heat is not absent. So that's part of the reason that that remains intact. Whereas some other states, they don't pay for days absent. Right. In regard to the chronic absenteeism, there's been a change where Oregon, for example, sports trips, the time,
right.
We said that that time was not included as days present. That was considered an absence. We have in the future, in the very near future, we'll be coming out with guidance that says just the opposite of that, is that the time that when they're under the supervision in with district staff, that would be considered a present. That would not be considered absence. So the chronic absenteeism rate will likely be changing as a result.
Thank you.
So ADMW is weighted
ADM,
and it's ADM adjusted by student cost weights.
I know.
And extended ADMW is higher of current or prior year ADMW to alleviate financial burden of a district in coping with sometimes abrupt change in ADM and associated ADMW. So use the bigger of the two.
Representative Reynolds.
I just wanted to clarify one point. If the student is absent 10 days in a row, they're disenrolled, correct?
Chair Nathanson, Representative Hernandez, that is correct. That the student, if they're absent for 10 consecutive days on that 10 day, then they're disenrolled and put on the inactive roster until they come back. However, if they are absent for 9 days and they come back on that 9th day, then the clock starts over. In some instances, we do see where we have students that are absent more days than they're actually present. But again, because our formula takes into account days present plus days absent, divides that in the total, in that case, they would still potentially receive a full ADM, albeit those are not very common, those instances, but you're absolutely right.
This topic is very interesting to me and potentially very important, but I trust that the Joint Committee on Student Success has it in their portfolio of something to discuss. Thank you.
Don't worry, I'll fix that.
So let's talk about cost factors in formula. It's roughly a couple of factors, student cost weights and teacher experience adjustment. So in calculating student cost weights, we will consider whether a student needs special education or if a student is an at-risk student. And it also depends on whether a district has only elementary K through 8 education or only high school, or the size. And then also depends on how remote the school is. And we're gonna get to the details of all this in the next slides. And there are three different costs that are independent of these two. There's transportation costs, high cost disability students, and then new facility costs. So these are cost factors that are considered in formula. So first, grants not dependent on ADMW. By the way, these grants come out of school district share, so we're focusing on school districts at this point. Transportation grant is 70 to 90% of approved transportation cost. That depends on district's cost per ADM. It's not it doesn't depend on weighted students. It depends on ADM. High cost disabilities grant. Oh, by the way, most schools, 80% of the school districts are on 70% reimbursement rate. High cost disability grant, up to district sum of approved cost above $30,000
for disability students, limited to $35 million per year, and prorated if statewide cost exceeds the limit. When I was beginning, the limit was $18 million, went up to $35 million. At the time of raising this limit to $35 million, reimbursement rate was about 80% or so. I'm sure because of escalating cost, probably a little less. Facility grant is up to 8% of district's total construction cost of new buildings. By the way, when a school district puts in a new building and about two school year window to apply for this facility grant after the first use of the classroom building. It is $9 million per biennium and prorated if statewide cost exceeds the limit. Out of $9 million from 19 session, $2 million will be taken out, so facility grant becomes seven. $2 million will be used for a healthy school facility fund. So we talked about transportation grant. That sort of reimbursement scheme, not 100%. High cost disabilities grant, not 100% reimbursement. There's a limit. Facility grant, just way below. Now, general purpose grant is the remaining one that depends on ADMW. So how is it distributed? It equals weighted students multiplied by this in the bracket, 45,000, excuse me, 4,500. Plus teacher experience adjustment. And that you calculate that first and then balance it to exhaust all the available fund. For example, if this is just a simple example, if the state school fund is $2 billion, and when you calculate it, the amount in the red bracket down below is $1 billion, then balance ratio will be 2 so that it exhausts all $2 billion available. That's how it works. So we'll have to talk about ADMW extended, and we'll have to talk about teacher experience adjustment. By the way, in the statute, 4,500 is called target grant, but that was the target grant when the formula started. That's the way it is with the formula. This is a simple formula, but it is very powerful. We'll get to that, but let's talk about ADMW extended first, and then teacher experience. So, In coming up with ADMW for a student, we start with one weight to each student. And these are additional weights. IEP students, special education students get additional. This is additional weight. English language learner, ELL or EL, has additional half weight. Students in poverty, neglected and delinquent students, and students in foster homes, they all get 0.25 additional weights. And pregnant and parenting student gets additional weight. So all these will be added to the one weight that each student has.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there not a weight for homeless students?
Homeless?
Homeless.
homeless.
Students who are identified as homeless.
Nathan, Representative Smith Warner, no, there is not a way currently for homeless students.
Because, if I may follow up, thank you. And partially that's because these weights were established and have not been significantly changed. Well, I mean, they're changed all the time. But at the same time, but the categories, that category did not exist, I would argue, in the 90s. That was not a conceptual thing when we established the formula.
Representative Smith Warner, I would agree with that assessment. And to your point that the weights typically do not change.
I'm not sure which one of you to ask. Could you prepare a short memo for this committee summarizing the history of the development of the formula and when certain updates happened so we can see how often things are adjusted or categories added, not just in student cost weights, but some of the other factors? I'd just like to see the history of how often we revisit it and update it. Thank you.
And there are additional consideration to student cost weight. It depends on whether a school district has only elementary school or high school. And there's some additional weights to remote small elementary schools. The cutoff is K through 8 with ADM of 252 or less. 9 through 12 of ADM 350 or less, but there are some additional requirements too. So they get additional weights and consideration.
I'd like to ask a sort of a big picture question about this. Now that we've seen a lot of different adjustments, and some of them are to address, it speaks to some schools are very small. In general, is the formula tending to subsidize the continuation of small schools or small districts, and therefore discouraging interest in either consolidating, not necessarily consolidating districts, but finding additional cost-efficient or more cost-efficient ways of doing administrative functions and so forth? I'm trying to be so careful as I word that.
Chair Nathanson, let me try to address this. As clearly, it's a very sensitive topic, and I don't remember the exact session, but I believe it was 2015, perhaps even 2013, that the small school correction came under review by the legislature. And I believe the sentiment that, because there was interest in adjusting that because of what you identify, is that there potentially is some savings. There was heartfelt testimony from around the state, and essentially if the school goes away because we're no longer assisting and adding additional weights to that, the community could possibly go away as well, as the transportation issues, where if the school goes away, students are having to be bused 2-3 hours. So that's the largest concern. But again, mm-hmm. just for the record, that you're aware that there was actually quite a bit of review on this just a few sessions ago.
Was there any discussion about it doesn't have to be either there is a school or there isn't a school, but just a way of doing business differently that could be more cost effective. The school would remain, but a different way of organizing, how to put this, the activities, the backroom functions, the business of having a school.
Representative Nathanson, that's also reviewed on a regular basis. And what I'm seeing from the data where I've reviewed the financial, again, where you're trying to consolidate administrative costs, superintendents, much of those services are now being provided by the ESDs. And so essentially you have just the teacher function at a lot of these smaller schools.
Okay.
So unless you're changing the delivery of education, for example, a virtual, mm-hmm. that's about the only way I can think of that might be savings. But a lot of the superintendent services, the actual administration, the business operations, payroll, accounts payable, what have you, is being provided by the regional ESD providers.
Thank you. So there has been a lot of effort at achieving cost efficiencies.
Representative Nathans, I would say yes.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair. Sorry, one more. Thank you, Madam Chair. So one last thing, just a point about the small high schools. So there is a weight in addition to the carve-out. So there's the carve-out at the front end, and there's the weight.
Representative Smith-Warner, the carve-out is for small high schools.
Mm-hmm.
That's $2.5 million. Even Washington County has a small high school. Aid from the carve-out, actually.
But this is an additional, or this is not the on the weight slide. So there's the carve-out plus there is the small high school weight.
Your question is: are there high schools that have small high school carve-out grants, and then also
yes, that is my question.
Yeah. Sure, Nathan, Representative Smith-Warner. To answer your question, do they receive the small high school grant in addition to the small high school correction? In most cases, that is true.
Okay.
Please keep in mind, though, that the small high school grant is $2.5 million. That's on an annual basis spread over many schools, so the amount per student is not much.
Thank you.
Thank you. So, now, about teacher experience adjustment. Being aware that more experienced teachers cost more, there is some adjustment. So the formula is this. First, you subtract statewide average from district average experience, and then multiply that by $25. So there are examples given, but looks small, but when you get to this black brackets, inside there's teacher experience adjustment. Now that's multiplied by ADMW. So that figure becomes quite big. So general purpose grant using extended ADMW plus transportation grant reimbursed at 70 to 90% rate, plus high cost disabilities grant up to district sum of approved cost above $30,000 per disability student, plus facility grant up to 8% of district's total construction cost of new buildings. Their facility grant is quite small. This is the state school fund distribution to school districts. Again, operationally, the difference between formula revenue and local revenue will be provided to school districts. For example,
Excuse me, I'm hoping that we can conclude in about 8 minutes to leave time for the other thing we need to finish up. So could we skip this slide and go to a couple of the slides where you're pointing out some really good big picture information? We could skip to maybe the pie chart. It's just a couple slides away.
Right.
It looks like that has some really important information for us.
Right. So this is an example for Salem-Keizer. Local revenue is 88. State school fund distribution is 337. Let's get to just additional information. This pie chart. State share is now. ODE provides data free of charge, but Doug Wilson at LFO claims copyright to these slides. So I may have to buy him a couple of lunch. So this is taken from LFO presentation to Education Sub until last session. Representative Smith-Warner was one of the co-chairs. So state portion is 2/3, local is 1/3. That's 1921, current service level school formula revenue. So the current service level, it's current service level without new programs or anything. So to maintain current service level, state school fund is 8.77. This local share of 4.299 is the number we provide to the school revenue technical committee. The school fund over the biennia, these are the shape we're in. We had terrible recession on 9/11, and we didn't quite get out of a recession until after the 11/13 session. So you see the formula funding just declining and staying flat and then moving up. We're really caught up in 13/15 and 15/17 session, and we continued our effort through 17/19. Again, for 1921, local revenue available is expected to be 4.3 billion. By the way, we'll have less common school fund distribution, so that's a negative. We're in the process of putting together our next forecast. Average daily membership relative to ADMW. Right now, it's about, ADM is about 575,000. And then ADMW is 710,000. So the difference is additional weights. And additional weights information over the years. The top one is IEP, special education students. By the way, IEP is capped at 11% of ADM, but with approval, they can go beyond that. Remember that IEP weight is 1, ELL weight is 0.5, then poverty is 0.25. So in terms of cases or the number of students, you have to multiply 2 or 4 accordingly. End of my presentation, and if you have any questions, Mike will answer.
Thank you very much. Yes, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to go back to the efficiencies that could be had in the smaller schools. I'm not sure a thorough conversation has really occurred, or perhaps even an accurate conversation. I represent a lot of those schools, and I'm not here to advocate for it, but I'm here to at least make sure facts are understood. If you looked at Wallowa County, and you realize you have the Wallowa School District, the Enterprise, the Joseph, and the Troy School District, of which in Troy, I was their keynote speaker a few years back with two graduates. I'm not sure that if there was a consolidation of activities that there wouldn't be savings. Now, maybe in the view of a larger school district, those savings may be viewed as insignificant. But in a small county, creation of one more teacher would be. And so I guess my question, Madam Chair, is I'm just curious at what level of investigation has occurred. Was it a bunch of folks sitting around a table saying this just won't happen? Or has there been a hard analysis that you could bring to the legislature to look at? And maybe that's a ways and means question, I admit that, but sometimes I put both hats on.
Chair Nathan, Representative Smith, as far as the an in-depth investigation, as far as are we finding maximum efficiencies, again, we do leave, the state does leave a lot of those decision-making to the local districts. But to answer your question, has there been an extensive review of this? To my knowledge, I have not been part of any of those investigations. I do look at the data. I do look at where the teachers are at. I do look at where the business or the administrators reside. And that's where I said that in the at least the top 20 smallest districts, a lot of those functions are provided at, by the ESD. But I've not been part of any in-depth investigation to see if they're, if we're maximizing efficiencies in our small districts.
And Madam Chair, I wouldn't disagree, and I'm in no way an expert on this, so I thoroughly admit that up front. While I think a lot of those administrative functions may be carried out by the ESD, I do think there are economies of scale that could be had, perhaps in the busing industry or in food service or in the sharing of teacher resources that could occur if two districts that perhaps don't always talk to each other had an opportunity to have more collaborative conversations because they were one. So anyway, I don't wanna go down that path too far because I gotta go back home to my district, but nonetheless, I think it is an honest conversation to have.
Thank you for raising the topic. Yes, Representative.
Just respond to Representative Smith, I have had that conversation with the two districts in my area, and the problem that we run into is we bump the student population above the small high school funding, so they start losing some of the benefits of being small. And so it's this kind of, you have to have a larger conversation. Yeah.
It's a good point. Yeah.
Very good point.
Can I say, I have one. Thank you. I stopped myself before. I just want to point out so that everybody understands the teacher number is to make sure that schools are not disadvantaged or given a perverse disincentive from hiring more experienced teachers. That teacher experience weight is important to make sure that there is a broader distribution. So I just wanted to make sure everybody kind of notices that in the formula.
Thank you. That's a good point. Yeah. That leads to one of the things I was looking at. After looking at all that detail, then I do want to have a better understanding. So why did we establish these weights? Is it to encourage or discourage certain behaviors?
Yeah.
And that to me is an even more important conversation. Yeah. And are they doing what we thought they would do or not? I have one final question. And if you can't answer it in like less than a minute, just send us a memo. When we talk about a budget of billions, money is sitting somewhere at some point. I'd like to understand a bit about the cash flow. Is there a huge chunk of money parked here or there or somewhere else, whether it's at the state or in the school districts? While the money is parked, it's earning interest, I would hope. What kind of interest is it earning? Like at the state, I know we have the short term, the intermediate term, and the long term pools, investment pools. What's happening to this money that's parked for a while, and where does the interest go?
I'll jump in here. Chair Nathanson, so for example, the state school fund, when we pull down funds to make the monthly mm-hmm. the payments, we identify exactly how much we're going to need for that month. And so the treasury only rolls that amount forward. So essentially, the corpus of the money is residing with the treasury, depending on receipts mm-hmm. of income tax as a primary source of that. Mm-hmm. As far as when the districts receive the money, you're correct in that the money goes into a local government pool that also draws interest on that there are some earnings. As far as contingency funds that districts for general accounting practices, typically we see upwards between 5 and 10%. Again, those are earning some interest, but again, those are contingencies. So there's, as far as where the money is just sitting collecting interest, the vast majority of it is in the treasury until it's sent to the districts, and then it's sent to pay for teachers primarily.
So the money that the districts have that's earning interest, do they rely on that interest just for ongoing operations throughout the year, or are they sending the interest to either reserve fund or to pay down the UAL or something like that?
Chair Nathanson, I think the strategies vary district to district depending on needs. But as far as their general operations, no, the interest is not used for the general operations, the lion's share of that. It is used at some point and is used, but as far, I really can't speak to that with any certain knowledge.
That's fine. Thank you. Any final questions for this panel? Thank you both for being with us today. We're ready to move to the last topic for this morning.
The next topic is Mazin's back to finish up some of the transportation highlights. He didn't quite get through all the slides, so he's going to hit some of the highlights to round things out for the orientation.
Thank you.
Morning, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. I'm back. By the way, the interest question is a very interesting one. I would like to talk to you about that. It's different. It works differently.
Good.
Yeah. What we've talked about yesterday, just to give you an idea or a recall of what we've done, is we've established.
Oh, excuse me. State your name for the record. I can't remember if you
said
that.
I thought I did, didn't I? Mazin Malik, Legislative Revenue Office.
Thank you.
I usually don't miss that one. This one, this time I did. We were talking yesterday about the transportation system. We got to the highway funding, and we described the system as a government or public system, owned system, done by a government, funded by taxation, that resembles to a large degree a user fee type of funding. So in that sense, there is those funds, there's two types. You have the fixed, as we economists like to have this, the fixed cost and the variable cost thing. So we do have those elements, both on the heavy side and the light side. And there's something that is coming new in the last few years, which is part of the, did not used to be part of the fixed cost, which is the title fees. Those are one time, but we still think of them as the buy-in into the system. Then you have the variable amounts that comes in, and that's primarily fuels tax and payment through, because the fuels tax always was a good simulation for use, for variable use, until the last few years when that relationship started divorcing from the concept because of the emergence of very high efficient vehicles, so that no longer the fuel tax is actually a perfect simulation for the use per mile. So that's how your fuel tax work, and in the sense that we measure this outcome of the variable, we look at what the amount or the yield of each penny of gas tax. And you would think if everything else was staying the same, the amount should be the same since 1970 and so on. So each penny, and that normalizes the increases and the change in taxes and so on. So, but now you look at it in this way, and each penny actually what used to bring in $10 million in 1970 brings about 18 now. So in about 40 years, 45 years time, there's like an 80% increase. That if you put things in more simplified ways, that's 2% increase per year. Now, that's contrary to what would be common sense, if you will, because the fuel tax supposedly is we're either driving less or having more efficient vehicles and so on, but there is still increase of 2% a year. So why is that happening? And that's where we start looking at things slightly differently and say, what about the cost? Is the cost going up, going down? And obviously the cost of the tax is going down. If you see in the red graph, this is the act, that's what we increase in statutes. This is the gas tax. If you look at it deflated either in $82, which is the yellow, or in $2016, which is the green, you see that we're paying less per mile, or you know, per gallon, than what you used to be. So the price is getting less. So why are we seeing all that increase? And this is an interesting graph. This comes from the EPA sources. And just to explain it a little bit, going that way, that means you have an increase in miles per gallon. That's the efficiency of the vehicle. And going up is an increase in horsepower. That's how powerful the engine is. So with time, when we started, and you remember in a certain time in the 1975, that's the year, and in the 70s, there was a decrease in horsepower, as you see, going down, and an increase in miles per gallon. This is the time of the Vega and the Pinto and the Gremlin, if you remember. Cars were very wimpy, but they gave you good gas mileage. And then all of a sudden, starting in the mid 80s, you see a huge climb in horsepower, while fuel efficiency did not suffer much. So what happened is that you climbed so fast to the point that we climbed about 92% in that. And then we resumed increasing miles per gallon after this, to the point that we have a 70% increase today, and 95% increase in miles per gallon, 70% increase in horsepower. Well. Sure. And that takes away different arguments of which affects what from you know, the pricing and the transportation, and basically says that we're driving more, and but each mile is costing us less. Also, with the variable, we go with the weight mile tax, the infamous or the famous weight mile tax. That because remember, price does not follow very neatly with the fuel efficiency. And trucks and cars have different relationships. Think about it. The rule of thumb is for each one truck damage on the road is about 400 vehicles. That's how the relationship usually works. Table B is a different set of taxes, and I'll show you a quick one. There's a flat fees and road use assessment fees. This is how the weight mile taxes look like. Basically, you go up with weight, you pay more as you have heavier amounts, and then if you establish more axles on your truck, you pay less. That's a reward for less damage on the road. So weight mile tax revenue also brings a good chunk of money. And you could see from these two dips that we have here at the 187 and 210 that weight mile tax is a lot more sensitive to economic turn and downturns than the other stuff. So the flat fees, road use assessment thing, this is how the general pie looks. And you see how dominant the fuel tax and the weight mile and reg fees as part of this. Now, to put all this in perspective, all the system.
We're past 9:45. Is the committee able to stay another 4 minutes? Maybe not.
Good ways to meet.
Yes. Some of this we may have heard. Could you? I want to be sure people see your last slide, which puts this in context. Slide 49.
It's today. 30th.
We have, you know, I'll speak while them. It's the that's a pricing system, obviously. We're very proud of it. Works very well. Proud in the sense that it gives a good pricing mechanism. Then you would have your federal revenue. And just to bring to your attention this thing here, for the first time ever we have, after the House Bill 2017, that fuel tax is actually slightly bigger than federal funds. That has not happened before. And then, you know, we have the different federal programs and the federal revenue. And, I mean, basically a lot of people talk about the demise of the federal revenue, and you judge for yourself if the federal revenue is actually losing or running out. So the road use fees, this is the new thing that is coming to, this is how things are changing in the coming years. Who is paying, who's not, is it road mile, user charge, tolling, and so on. And that is basically a picture of how things are in different states when it comes to road user charges and tolling. That things are different in every state, basically.
They surely are, and often we talk about things being similar on the West Coast. Certain kinds of things were very similar to our neighbors to the north and south, but on this particular map, we're not similar. Are there any final questions for today's presentation? Yes,
we have a private operating entity running our road use fees in this state.
Well, in the road user fees, we have the private operating entity that is actually we contract to, and then.
Oh right, Orgo.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And then, you know, we also contract a couple of our tolls. We have tolls, toll bridges that are very small on the Columbia, not very well known or advertised, but we have them, and we kind of contract.
What about the Buena Vista Ferry?
We have that too.
Thank you very much. We're done for today.
Still
yes, we're adjourned.